This is SG2 Perspectives, a conversation with industry experts and SG2 thought leaders about the biggest trends in healthcare and what we all expect that's going to mean for the future of healthcare delivery.
I would think that coming out of this, that primary care, you know, 2 years from now begins to look a lot differently. Things that were already in play in the retail space, in the virtual health space, as well as in team-based care models under risk, particularly Medicare Advantage, that those begin to increase and gain a lot more attraction.
Hello and welcome to SG2 Perspectives. I am your host, Kelly Richard. Today, we'll be discussing how COVID-19 is likely to impact the physician landscape. I have with me on the podcast today, Dr. David DiLoretto, principal on our consulting team with years of experience practicing medicine and serving in an executive capacity, and Mike Strzeleski, also a principal on our consulting team with extensive expertise in healthcare strategy, particularly physician alignment and value-based care. Thank you both for joining me today.
It's my pleasure. Hi, Mike. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, David. Hi, Kelly. Nice to talk to you guys today.
This is part two of a two-part episode this week, how COVID-19 is reshaping the physician landscape. In part one, we talked about the challenges that physician practices are experiencing and changes to care delivery. In part two, we're going to discuss how market activity, practice ownership, and business models could start to evolve in the coming months. In part one of this episode, both of you described the precarious financial situation that many practices are finding themselves in due to the reduced demand for office visits and elective services. Over the past couple of years, health systems, payers, and private equity groups have been buying up physician practices. Could COVID-19 be the impetus for another round of M&A?
I think that's a fair assumption, Kelly. There's sort of broader economic perspectives that I think drive that. I think a lot of the activity on physician practices over the last handful of years has sort of been a function of, in general, the valuations across a lot of companies have gone up, and maybe healthcare and particularly physicians were viewed as more of a value buy from a private equity standpoint, because it's sort of an interesting pursuit in many ways from a private equity viewpoint. Specialists represent an ability to capture market share as volume has moved to the outpatient space, and they've sort of monetized their ability to drive value through ancillaries and surgery centers and things like that. And primary care has been valuable to aggregate lives around Medicare Advantage. Private equity continue to see opportunities with groups that they can consolidate or that have consolidated in markets that own market share in those two spaces, whether you're a proceduralist or a primary care physician. I think the big will get bigger, right? And the small will be absorbed. So, and I think that's kind of a common theme we're hearing across lots of industries sort of post this pandemic environment.
Yeah, I think there will be increased M&A activity, but I think it'll be very different than it's been in the past. Clearly, the ability to provide services outside of an acute care setting will be at a premium. And particularly in the retail space, folks like Walmart really looks like, you know, they've developed a model now that they're comfortable with expanding. And it's a model that actually will serve folks well in the economic downturn that we're entering. I think you could see them expand fairly actively. The same with CVS. So, you know, the growth in retail healthcare delivery should increase. As Mike points out, private equity groups are well posed for looking for some essentially bargains out there, you know, particularly in single specialty groups that have ambulatory care capabilities that help reinforce their portfolio that already includes ASCs and diagnostic imaging. And I think you'll see health insurers probably look for ways to secure, you know, more effective networks. They're going to come out pretty good in 2020, even going into 2021. And I think they're going to be looking for, you know, partnership opportunities with providers and health systems or outright acquisitions, if that's the strategy that the health plan is pursuing. And I think it'll probably start in, you know, in the next 60 days. It's very likely that those folks who have a lot of liquidity, you know, HCA has got, you know, close to $20 billion on their balance sheet of cash, Ascension Health the same way, they'll be looking for strategic acquisitions to help support their delivery systems.
Right. And I noticed that you mostly focused on payers and other types of entities. So it sounds like it could be some health systems, but probably just the very large and cash rich entities. Is that right?
Well, if we get to the health system level, if on average U.S. health systems operating margin in the last quarter of 2019, let's say, was 2%, I think probably in the first and second quarter of this year, we're going to be looking on average at folks with negative 5 to 6% operating margins. Unless you were well capitalized and had a lot of liquidity, you're basically going to be looking at cutting costs pretty actively at the health system and already are. And that's not going to escape their employed physician groups. You know, there's going to have to be restructuring for a lot of health systems with respect to their physician networks. While some of them will be on acquisition sprees, I think more of them will be acquisition targets.
Yeah. And when we're thinking about the way then that health systems are keeping market share and aligning with physicians, are there other physician alignment models beyond acquisition, as it is really expensive to employ physicians, that you think make more financial sense for health systems?
Yes, I do. I think, and Mike will chime in here as well, I'm really seeing some really innovative activities going on right now around the country, particularly with health systems looking at independent physicians who are part of their medical staff and finding ways to support them through these difficult times. I think we will see the use of some innovative MSO arrangements to support practices. I have a client recently who's bringing their furloughed workers back into the health system, and they want to eliminate the bureaucracy of HR paper and have it all done through a smartphone app and make it as efficient as possible. And then they realize their independent physician practices that are, you know, part of their medical staff have the same challenges. And so they're putting that app into the services that they can actually offer. Many of these practices need virtual health workflow support. You know, they've started to actually use virtual health services, but they don't have it fully integrated into their EHR, or the workflows aren't worked out. And so, you know, that's become part of their MSO service offerings. And so I think we'll clearly see some innovation in this space, particularly with new ways of offering preventive services, new ways of you know, monitoring patients remotely, those types of capabilities that health systems can fund and implement. They can extend the use of those services to independent physicians as well.
Yeah, it's kind of an expanded resurgence of the MSO.
Yeah, with some technology innovation in it to, you know, account for the fact that people are going to be self-quarantining, large numbers of patients are not going to be able to have face-to-face encounters.
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, the MSO is trying to address the administrative complexity and cost of just running a practice, right? And that's what has driven a lot of physicians to employment, because they just don't want to deal with it. It's been expensive. The regulatory challenges are hard to keep up with. The talent pool can be challenging to keep just in terms of running the practice. So they just frankly want someone else to worry about it. Right, David?
You're right. And even within health system employed practices, I think there's going to be some significant changes as well. Probably more of a move to team-based care. We've mentioned the economic downturn that's ahead and the fact that health systems are, on average, will be pushed into negative operating margins. The average loss per FTE physician in the employed groups is probably about $200,000 to $225,000 per FTE physician right now. If you've got a negative operating margin, you're going to be hard-pressed to go out and employ more into that model with those losses. And so folks are going to be looking at how to expand panels, how to use team-based care. I've had a couple of folks use some innovative bonus awards. Mike mentioned earlier that typically groups will go out and pay those bonuses out in the first quarter for the previous fiscal year. A lot of folks who had to maintain liquidity moved to non-cash bonuses, you know, things like expansion of CME credits and PTO and things that allowed them to actually reward physicians in meaningful ways, but at the same time, preserve cash for the future.
And along sort of the same vein as, you know, when we're thinking about the MSO and other physician alignment mechanisms, the fee-for-service business model hasn't offered too much stability in this specific situation. Do you see the pandemic as accelerating physicians toward value-based care adoption? And when I'm thinking about that, I'm thinking about clinically integrated networks or ACOs. Are those other ways that physicians could become aligned to health systems and also potentially have a more sustainable business model than the fee-for-service model is currently offering them?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting idea to play forward for certain groups, particularly primary care, right? Where I think it's that's sort of the argument for primary care value-based payment is that in a time like this, if you're mostly capitated or you're getting some sort of value-based payments, there's cash coming in the door, whether you're seeing a patient or not, right? Now, that does sound better than strictly fee-for-service, but I think we can't ignore the fact that still fee-for-service represents the foundation for how most physicians are paid. Value-based payments are typically a portion of it, some as small as 5%, maybe some as high as 20 to 30% of the overall revenue could be value-based, but things like the virtual visits and those things become really a fee-for-service infrastructure, I think, that incentivizes that shift. We touched on this with the MSO piece and sort of the small business dynamic and scale. It's sort of the administrative complexity of doing all of this, right? And if it's actually cheaper to manage your practice in a fee-for-service environment in terms of you need less resources, less people, and you can leverage technology and scale to be efficient, like in a virtual environment, I think there's an argument to be made that that approach is more nimble and might be better. Now, the flip side is the value-based world, potentially in an environment where you're caring for some really sick patients and you have to be a little more innovative in how you do that. And you have to extend beyond the practice walls and leverage remote patient monitoring and leverage different kind of care management resources. I think there's certainly an argument to be made that if you do that effectively, that that's a great space to be in too. So I'm not sure it's one or the other, Kelly. I think it depends on the market. It depends on the practice profile and sort of their vision for how they want to care for their patients.
Part of the equation here is also what happens in the U.S. economy. Today, we've got 20% of people unemployed. It's hard to imagine, again, without effective therapies, without a vaccine, with circulating virus still in place, that there won't be significant unemployment for the next 12 to 18 months, which means a loss of commercial insurance, more movement to government programs where value-based care really begins to make a lot more sense. Particularly Medicare Advantage could expand pretty quickly here, particularly if there's early retirements and folks aging into Medicare. I think you'll see opportunities for expansion of Medicare Advantage services. I think healthcare providers right now should enter into renegotiation with their health plans. It's very clear from an actuarial standpoint that health plans' total expenses this year and into next year will be decreased because of the demand destruction in areas that we've already talked about. At the same time, those health plans are going to want to have stable networks. And so I think there's a great opportunity right now to reopen negotiations and begin to work out a partnership for the future that invariably, I think, will involve aspects of value-based care, but also really looking at the value that needs to be created to do that. CMS has already backed off of moving MSSP ACOs into more risk-based arrangements this year. They've delayed that for a year, understanding that there is not only disruption in demand and uncertainty about expense profiles for these ACOs, but the infrastructure requirements are still fairly steep for practices. And that's where I think health plans in particular can be able to help these groups. So I think you will see eventually more move to value-based care, particularly in government programs.
Mm-hmm. It's almost as though the idea and the theory of having a different sort of model in place is great, but the lack of capital for investing in this type of infrastructure makes it a little bit of a barrier right now.
I think the sort of the barrier around investment is going to be particularly true for practices that haven't started that journey, that don't have either a health system partner, a CIN, even private equity that have come alongside to sort of create that scale. So I think that's absolutely true. But that kind of is going to fall into the sort of how the small get aggregated at some level, right, into some of those camps. But while the groups that have are maybe more mature in their value-based approach and infrastructure, I think there's a way to continue to make that a differentiator and continue to make that sort of financially successful for the practice. And there's a space for it because of just the prevalence of chronic disease and aging of the population and the costs. I mean, even while the demand is going down at some level, which even is surprising within those patient segments, which we still can't quite explain, right? That when, as that returns and as those patients start to be managed more appropriately, I mean, the costs are there and the opportunity is there to do that more efficiently.
And we still have sort of the actuarial challenge of a pandemic, you know, so obviously in hot spots like New York and New Orleans and Detroit, the tri-state area around New York, those COVID-related costs are probably pretty significant. And in large parts of the country, this demand destruction, while in the near term decreases healthcare costs, there's now emerging evidence that folks are foregoing, you know, important monitoring and preventive services. So folks with chronic disease could actually end up really incurring some costs down the road in the next couple of years if this persists. And so I think with that actuarial uncertainty, there have to be, you know, new ways of assessing risk and actually creating risk corridors particularly for providers who go into risk arrangements.
That's a really important point that I think we believe we're going to see a decrease in overall health expenditures. If you're in a performance-based risk-sharing agreement today with a health plan, you might expect at the end of the year, your shared savings are going to be great. And you may max out whatever your potential payment is just because of the environment we're in right now. But the reality is those cost savings were not directly attributed to the activities of the physicians or the delivery system, more attributed to kind of the overall shutdown. So I guess the question for me is, will the health plans actually pay those performance rewards back to the physicians, or will they invoke sort of a force majeure kind of clause and sort of deem those payments inappropriate given the environment? And then will those at-risk patients that deferred care, will that carry into the following year? And do the health plans sort of anticipate an increase in expenditures? And so they're sort of bracing for that. And then complicated with all of this is nothing is static. So you've got unemployment and you've got patients moving off of their employer-driven or employer-sponsored health plans to other plans or Medicare, Medicaid, whatever it might be. So it's a complicated environment, I think, to be an actuary at the moment.
Absolutely. And when you talk about risk corridors and sort of limits to the amount of loss that physicians can take or will have to, one model that I've thought about, and I'm wondering if I could bounce this off of you, and I've heard this and read it in a couple of different places, but the idea that primary care providers could just carve out the 3-5% spend as a target and really do sort of a direct to primary care model, just because it would be tough for them to completely blow past their target, given that nothing very catastrophic happens in primary care. Is that a model that could help some of the physicians that really are practicing on that front line and really in the ambulatory space and not really be as affected by the overall total cost of care that we may see when patients start coming back into the facilities?
You know, that is an interesting thought, Kelly. And my first reaction is that, you know, it would depend on the actuarial model. It would depend on what that primary pool of funds actually looks like. The other value of a primary care physician in that network, though, is their ability to make sure that care is coordinated effectively. And so the model would have to take into consideration that. In the early days of capitation, when many of us, you know, started doing in the late 80s and 90s, a lot of models where you had pools just for primary care services, what we found is there was a lot of care avoidance and folks not necessarily getting the right care or the alternative was they were getting referred pretty quickly to specialists, simply to avoid actually having to draw on those primary care funds. And so you'd have to make sure that's not happening. I think we're more likely to see some very innovative primary care models emerge. I wouldn't underestimate what's going to happen in the retail space. You know, you've got some firms that are really like Walmart who've really been thinking about this. They believe they can provide care, good care for primary care and chronic disease services at a very, very low cost point. And I think virtual health is going to do the same thing. I would think that coming out of this, that primary care, you know, 2 years from now begins to look a lot differently. Things that were already in play in the retail space, in the virtual health space, as well as in team-based care models under risk, particularly Medicare Advantage, that those begin to increase and gain a lot more attraction. And I think you're going to see health plans actually catalyze this as well.
Yeah, I think, Kelly, just to build off of that, I mean, I think at the end of the day, for primary care, they're trying to create a simpler and more predictable revenue stream that will cover what they believe are the appropriate expenses to care for their patients. And I think if you talk to any primary care physician today, they're frustrated about the cost of running their practice in terms of the amount of infrastructure it takes, the amount of people it takes, whether that's on the billing side or whatnot. So if they can simplify the administrative process of collecting the revenue they need to care for the patients that they have attributed to them, I think they're going to gravitate towards that as much as they can. And I think it does support, you know, given what we're experiencing right now, that might actually create some innovation around what services or resources are most impactful at the moment to managing the needs of patients.
One of the things I think also will emerge in primary care is better coordinated and lower cost concierge or subscription services. Folks like Forward Health and One Medical that were getting a lot of traction in the commercial space with a low cost delivery model for concierge services. I think that you could definitely see that expand. And so I would watch that, you know, particularly in the next six months.
Yeah, and I think that a theme in many of our episodes here on COVID-19 is that this crisis is really amplifying many of the issues or weaknesses that our system currently has. So if we can find some sort of a silver lining, the idea that it will accelerate any sort of disruption or innovation, that could be pretty exciting. And hopefully we'll see some great partnerships and new business models come out of this. David and Mike, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Kelly.
Yeah, thank you.
If you like what you're hearing, please also listen and subscribe to our colleague Tom Villanueva's Modern Practice podcast on Vizient's Medical Leadership Channel. Tom discusses key healthcare trends through the clinical leadership lens. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening and stay healthy.
This has been another great episode of SG2 Perspectives, where industry experts and SG2 thought leaders explore the drivers of tomorrow's healthcare strategies to inform today's decision makers. Contact us anytime by sending an email to sg2perspectives@sg2.com. We'd love to hear from you. SG2 revolutionized healthcare demand forecasting with the Impact of Change forecast, and today, we're the industry's premier strategy advisory firm. To learn more, visit sg2.com. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you again soon.